It's Friday, June 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Barack Obama's free trade agenda faces a key vote in the House of Representatives.
If it's defeated, there will be at least, I would say, a couple of years, maybe much longer, before people will gather up their strength and try another time and actually wait for another administration.
The latest round of peace talks begin in Geneva involving Yemen on Sunday, and we'll get some perspective from a former U.S. ambassador. And a new film takes us back to the era of hip-hop. It's all ahead. The U.S. Congress appears headed for a showdown vote Friday on granting Trade Promotion Authority, or TPA, to President Obama. Now, it's seen as a crucial precondition to eventual conclusion of years of negotiation on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade and Investment Agreement. TPA allows a president the ability to reach trade agreements and submit them to Congress for an up or down vote, but no changes. The TPP, once finalized among its current 12 Pacific Rim partners, would reduce or eliminate tariffs, open up nations to more trade and investment, harmonize regulations, and protect labor and environmental standards. The Republican-dominated Senate has already approved Trade Promotion Authority. Now it's up to the Republican-controlled House of Representatives, where most of Mr. Obama's Democratic allies oppose TPA over the potential job losses and stagnating wages that often follow new trade agreements. Some Republicans are concerned about granting Mr. Obama more executive authority, especially following the publication of secretive documents surrounding the TPP negotiations by the website WikiLeaks, which suggest approval would give Mr. Obama new powers to change immigration policy. Gary Huffbauer of the Washington-based Peterson Institute of International Economics tells VOA's Victor Beatty, if the TPA legislation fails in the House, it would mark a big pause in U.S. leadership in international economic integration.
If it's defeated, there will be at least, I would say, a couple of years, maybe much longer, before people will gather up their strength and try another time and actually wait for another administration. The defeat would be a big thing. I don't think it will be defeated. I think the House will vote in favor of fast-track authority, and then that will point towards approval of the Trans-Pacific Partnership later on when the negotiations are concluded. And, of course, that's a big thing, too, both for the economic and political significance.
Countries like Japan are watching this debate very closely.
Yes, Japan is watching very closely. Canada, other countries, because these countries are not going to put their best offers on the table in terms of lowering their own barriers to agricultural imports and some industrial goods until they see that the U.S. can deliver on whatever commitments the U.S. makes in negotiations.
Conservative blogs and other websites have suggested that some of the secret aspects of this trade deal that they've not been made public have to deal with immigration, other issues that are of concern to conservatives. Will those be assuaged in time for this vote?
Well, I don't think they'll be assuaged in time for the vote. I think they're wrong in the speculation that there will be immigration proposals in the agreement, but probably there will be features that they don't like. I mean, every big agreement, and this is a big agreement, represents compromise, and that means that there are some features that U.S. legislators won't like and some features that, let's say, Japanese or Vietnamese or Mexican legislators won't like. But hopefully there's more that they like than they don't like, and the agreement, if concluded, will be ratified.
What do you make of President Obama's recent remarks in an interview that China is looking closely at joining TPP?
I've been to China quite a bit. I don't think joining in the near term is likely, but I do think that the Chinese economic ministries and scholars will look very closely at the terms of TPP with a view towards aligning Chinese economic policies so that, let's say, in 5 years' time, joining or working out a negotiation with TPP is a real possibility.
again, we want to remind people that this is not the TPP that's up for a vote in the House on Friday, but rather giving the president fast-track authority. How important is that?
Well, that's very important, because without this authority, whatever is negotiated by U.S. negotiators would be subject to amendment in the Congress. And because of that, foreign negotiators won't believe that the U.S. negotiators can be serious, and that would pretty well kill the negotiations. So the TPA is really the gateway to the TPP.
Gary Huffbauer of the Peterson Institute of International Economics. Central Asia has become an increasing source of foreign fighters for radical militant groups operating in the Middle East, notably the Islamic State. The group's aggressive recruiting targets vulnerable young men in countries with declining economic prospects and repressive governments. Zlata Sahok reports on what motivates people to join the radical Islamists and what can be done to stop them.
The United Nations estimates that Islamic State and related groups have at least 25,000 foreign fighters from more than 100 countries. According to data from the U.S. Counterterrorism Center, Islamic State has already recruited hundreds of people from Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan and more than 1,000 men from Kazakhstan.
Just last week, we learned that the chief of Tajikistan's counterterrorism program, someone highly trained by the United States government, abandoned his post to join ISIS.
Experts say some of the challenges that Central Asian governments face are of their own making: widespread corruption, lack of the rule of law, and violation of human rights. Unemployment and poor economic prospects add to popular discontent. Radical groups exploit these factors to attract young people to their cause. The United States is working with regional governments to prevent the dissemination of terrorist messages through social media and the cross-border flow of fighters.
While there are no reliable statistics, research suggests that the vast majority of Central Asian fighters in Syria and Iraq are recruited while outside their own countries, mostly while in Russia, where millions of them live as migrant workers.
Experts say there is no simple solution to the problem, but a key long-term effort must include improving the economic prospects so young people can work at home, where radicalization is less likely to take place than in migrant communities. While the United States can help in that effort, some say the real solutions will be local.
They're the ones closest to the action, they're the ones who know their communities, and they're the ones who are ultimately going to either detect and or prevent or respond to an incident.
Experts say that governments in Central Asia and elsewhere also must improve their human rights record and prevent marginalization of minorities. Zlata Sahok, VOA News, Washington.
Joining me here in the studio now is social media editor Andrew Polshevsky with a look at what's trending today. Andrew, what's happening?
Well, we just heard that report about the recruitment of young people, and we have this here in the U.S., a teen in the U.S. state of Virginia pleading guilty to supporting ISIS. But it's interesting how he did it. Ali Shukri Amin was advocating for ISIS on Twitter and actually taught members of the group how to use Bitcoin, which is the online currency that ISIS is using to pay for a lot of things because they can't use banks. So he was in court yesterday about that, but it's interesting that here, even in the U.S., we're having these cases of social media assistance. They may not be traveling overseas to help ISIS, but they're helping them online.
Huh, interesting.
Absolutely. Another story I wanted to bring up, and another hashtag that's trending here in the U.S., is hashtag transracial. Now, this is a story out of the U.S. state of Washington. A woman named Rachel Dojol, she is apparently a white woman, but was pretending to be an African-American, a leader of the NAACP chapter in Spokane, Washington, which is the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. It's an African-American advocacy organization. She was pretending to be African-American and saying, well, even though I was born white, this is the race that I feel that I am. And so this hashtag transracial has been trending, people comparing it to being transgendered, saying if you can be born in a body that is not the gender that you feel you are, why can't it be the same for race? So it's prompting a lot of ridicule for her. A lot of people saying, no, this is not the same as being transgendered, it's completely different. But a lot of discussion online on Twitter. So this topic causing a lot of debate. And again, we're seeing how social media can be this forum where people can talk about these issues and raise these issues.
Hmm. That is interesting.
Yeah. And then finally, we'll end with a light note, because it is Friday here. Hashtag Apple Watch pool prank. There's a gentleman, his name is Troy Sivan. He is an actor, a South African actor, but he's actually better known for his YouTube videos. And what he did was his brother had ordered the Apple Watch. He took the watch out of the box, filled the box with apples, and pretended to accidentally drop the box in their pool and watched his brother freak out and film that. And then his brother opened the box, saw it was filled with apples. But this video is going all over viral on the internet. People are sharing it, laughing about it, and saying it's kind of mean, but also pretty funny.
Wonder how the brothers will get along now.
Huh? Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah.
Well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers in northern Chile at the European Southern Observatory's Very Large Telescope, or VLT, snapped some sharp images that for the first time showed the birth of a bipolar planetary nebula. A nebula is a cloud of ionized gas that has been ejected by a red giant or a dying star. The red giant that spawned the butterfly-like planetary nebula is called L2 Puppis. It's only 200 light-years away and is one of the closest red giants to Earth. The new images also clearly show a nearby but dimmer and smaller companion star. The researchers believe that the companion star played a role in creating the bipolar planetary nebula, which was produced by the enormous quantity of dust circling the dying star. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a new film portrays the beginning of hip-hop in American music. The United States is welcoming the announcement that the UN-facilitated consultations among Yemeni stakeholders will begin in Geneva on June 14th. John Kirby is the State Department spokesman. He said that we reiterate the call of the Security Council for Yemenis to attend these talks in good faith and without preconditions. We urge Yemenis participating in the talks to work towards a rapid resumption of the Yemeni political transition process in line with the GCC initiative, National Dialogue Conference outcomes, and related UN Security Council resolutions. Well, VOA senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi explored the potential role of UN mediation and U.S. policy options in Yemen with Stephen Sesh, a former U.S. ambassador to Yemen. And Mohammed joins us now. Mohammed, what role did Ambassador Sesh envision for the UN in trying to end the conflict in Yemen?
Sir, Ambassador Sesh expects a crucial role for UN mediation, but under certain conditions.
I think ultimately the UN is going to play a very important role. I think that fundamentally, if we can get the parties to agree on the cessation of the hostilities, then the UN can come back into Yemen and probably, working very closely with the Yemeni political establishment, try to restart the original kind of framework of negotiations, which is the National Dialogue Conference outcomes, and the movement towards a kind of a new redrafting of the Constitution that will recognize new political parties and a new alignment of political influence in the country. And that includes what the Houthis clearly will bring to the table at this point.
But the announced object of the Saudi-led military action was to restore the legitimate government in Yemen and restart the political dialogue. Mohammed, did the campaign achieve that?
According to the former U.S. ambassador to Yemen, the Saudi-led campaign did not achieve this goal, and he explains that. Let's listen to what he said.
Mohammed, I'm not sure that it has achieved the goals that the Saudis have articulated or did articulate at the beginning of the campaign, which were twofold, as I understood them, one of which was to restore the legitimate regime of President Rabu Mansour Hadi, and the second goal was to have the Houthis withdraw from the territory they seized prior to when they overtook the government in Sana'a and basically lay down and return the heavy weapons they've seized along the way as well. As I say, neither one of these goals have been achieved so far. And
well, the U.S. has been dealing with Yemen as a front to combat terrorist groups affiliated with al-Qaeda. Would the crisis in Yemen change the U.S. policy options there?
Well, Ambassador Sesh has some recommendations for the Obama administration to that effect.
I think what we have to do is be able to really broaden effectively our engagement in Yemen. We have, for too long, we have been almost had our hand forced into a very heavy counterterrorism focus in Yemen. And that's a very genuine and real concern, and it needs to be addressed. But at the same time, we can't address the long-term causes of why this exists in Yemen without getting into the very important development aspects, human capital, resources, infrastructure, the things that will make life in Yemen more tolerable and more appealing and make Yemenis themselves more optimistic about their future, and where they will not turn then to the kind of siren call of the extremist organizations, which has been so effective in some cases, and also allowed the AQAP and others to find a very very long-term and effective safe haven and refuge for themselves in Yemen.
Thanks very much, Mohammed. That report by Mohammed El-Shenawy. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's premier newsmaker interview program. If you have ideas for guests or topics or want to comment on one of our programs, please write to us at Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. That's Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or if you have access to the internet, send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is PCUSA@voanews.com. We look forward to hearing from you.
A defining moment in hip-hop music is now nearly three decades old, but it's been revived with a fresh cinematic twist, as David Byrd and Shauna Renee have stopped by our studios to discuss.
It has been 27 years since N.W.A.'s album Straight Outta Compton revolutionized hip-hop. Now a new movie aims to portray that time and the members of the group. To talk about this, Shauna Renee joins me in the studio. Shauna, thank you for being with me.
As always, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Now, N.W.A. was responsible for really a revolution in hip-hop. I mean, they brought that really raw street sound into the main mix, did they not?
Into the mainstream, absolutely. Up until that point, up until around 1988, 1989, hip-hop music existed primarily on the East Coast, number one. There was a West Coast music industry, hip-hop culture, but it wasn't as prominent or popular or well-known as what was going on in the East Coast. Also, at that time, hip-hop was a party music. It was, you know, what you played at the barbecues, and you danced, and you had a great time, and it was about, you know, life may be hard, but we're still trying to make it. Then out of nowhere, N.W.A. comes and says, hold on, wait a minute. Life isn't as good as they're saying it is. Not for us here in Los Angeles, where we're dealing with a whole lot of issues, including drugs and crime and police brutality and all of that. So it was those stories that revolutionized the way most young people saw hip-hop as a tool for expression and storytelling.
Now, this movie portrays the lives of all the people in N.W.A., the folks that people might recognize immediately, Eazy-E, Ice Cube, Dr. Dre, but it's the whole crew that's portrayed.
Right, DJ Yella and MC Ren are also portrayed, and it tells the story of how each of the members came together to form the group, and then it also goes on to tell the story of how the group eventually disbanded. They do spend some time with Eazy-E's life and also his death, and so this movie is actually very is very interesting and very important in that there are a lot of stories that a lot of things that happened within that group, stories that are speculative or rumored to be true or not, that I think, according to Ice Cube at least, will be cleared up.
I understand that Ice Cube's son was going to play him in the movie and Eazy-E's son was going to play him in the movie.
Yeah,
work out?
That didn't work out as well. There was a lot of speculation, too, about who would be directing the movie, who would be producing producing it. At first, we thought John Singleton would be directing the movie, which I thought would have been incredible.
Yeah.
But as it turns out, F. Gary Gray directed the movie, which is going to be released in August. And he's done Friday. He worked with Ice Cube on Friday and Set It Off. And he's done a number of music videos for Ice Cube and Queen Latifah and Outkast. So he knows the hip-hop culture just as well, if not, you know, better than John Singleton.
Now, this movie is not necessarily for kids, though. This has got an R rating, definitely for language and violence.
Well, there's nothing about N.W.A. that was for kids.
That
ever.
Was PG.
That was, yeah. So, yeah, no surprise. This is not for kids. And in fact, you know, N.W.A. was one of the groups that is responsible for why we have those stickers and labels on music that say parental advisory, explicit lyrics.
Well, we're looking forward to it. You know, we would love to know your opinion about N.W.A. We'd also love to hear from you. If you're on Twitter, you can hit up Shauna at VOA underscore music. She's also the hostess of the Soul Lounge. You can find her at www.voanews.com. Shauna, thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's the way it goes in the city of Compton, boy.
Sounds of hip-hop there. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks very much for joining us, and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's been 26 years since China's violent suppression of pro-democracy demonstrators in Beijing's Tiananmen Square. Protesters, many of them students, had gathered in the capital and around the country for weeks to demand political change and respect for the fundamental human rights they were being denied by the government. It is not known how many people were killed in the violent confrontation, which was followed by a roundup of protest participants. Chinese authorities have tried to expunge the event from China's official history by censoring discussion of what occurred and by making sure no commemorations take place on Tiananmen Square. The world, however, remembers the events of June 4th, 1989. The world remembers the iconic photograph taken from a Beijing hotel room of a single young man standing up to a Chinese army tank, a photograph that captures the valiant spirit of individuals throughout history who unabashedly demand their rights. In a press statement, State Department spokesperson John Kirby took note of the 26th anniversary of the violent suppression of peaceful protests in and around Tiananmen Square. The United States, he said, continues to call for an official accounting of the victims of these events, the release of those still serving Tiananmen-related sentences, and an end to the harassment and detention of those who wish to peacefully commemorate the anniversary. Mr. Kirby said, while China has achieved social and economic progress since 1989, the United States remains concerned that human rights violations in China continue. We are closely monitoring developments with respect to pending legislation in China relating to national security, counterterrorism, and the regulation of NGOs that appears to call into question China's commitment to increased openness and could, if enacted in current form, result in rights abuses, said spokesperson Kirby. On this 26th anniversary, the United States urges the Chinese government to uphold its international commitments to protect human rights and fundamental freedoms, and to end the harassment, detention, and other mistreatment of individuals who peacefully seek justice and fairness, to practice their religion, or to express their views.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.